At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
That's what's cool, that I'm getting paid and I'm a sellout. Wow.
But I don't make rap music. I make, you know, I just make whatever I like. You can't really categorize it or put me in a box or anything, you know.
Like, he should keep his foot in the door to make it clear, yo, I wasn't just culture vulturing you before.
Music is part image, but overall, I mean, it's not visual. You know what I'm saying?
White rappers have always been controversial. Whether it's for being a culture vulture, being corny, or their music being trash, we rarely see them in a positive light. However, the highest selling rapper of all time is Eminem, who is a white rapper. So clearly, they are successful. Yet, with all their achievements, white rappers often find themselves fighting for respect, leading to the question, why does hip-hop not take white rappers seriously? Why do they get called culture vultures? And who are the rappers who have suffered from this? Hi, my name is Rashad Bashir, and this is why hip-hop doesn't respect white rappers. Of course, before we go any further, we have to define culture vulture. A culture vulture is a person who adopts something from a different community and makes it their own. And there are plenty of examples of culture vultures in rap, ranging from absolutely heinous to what some deem as not bad at all. But there's one rapper in particular who embodies the term culture vulture, Post Malone. So let's begin with him. Although Post Malone became a significant figure in rap, with hits like Rockstar and Congratulations dominating the charts, many fans argued that he was merely a white artist capitalizing on black culture without respecting its roots, raising the question of whether or not he really cared about the culture. And it didn't take long for Post Malone to make things worse. It all began with a 2017 interview where he said, "If you're looking for lyrics, if you're looking to cry, if you're looking to think about life, don't listen to hip hop. Right now, there's not a lot of people talking about real shit. Whenever I want to cry, I'll listen to some Bob Dylan." That's a pretty bold claim, and it didn't sit well with the hip-hop community, who believed that Post Malone didn't understand the genre he was profiting off of. One of those people was Charlamagne.
You know what it was? Post had made these statements one time that I didn't appreciate because it was like, yo, he came up in rap music, you know what I mean? So he had the song White Iverson.
Who explained that what Post said was just not true.
The statement was like, if you want to cry or listen to, you know, music that has a deeper meaning, you know, don't listen to rap or something like that. And I'm like,
but it kind of goes, but it,
like, not only did you come up in hip hop, but that's just not true.
And Post would address the fans like Charlamagne, who claimed he didn't appreciate hip hop and decided to say this.
You know, a lot of people saying that I don't appreciate hip hop or I'm taking advantage of hip hop. My last hip hop album was fucking hip hop. My next hip hop album is fucking hip hop.
And that he basically wanted to redefine hip hop altogether.
I love hip hop. I make hip hop. I want to take this genre, you know, and stretch it so far that people who may not listen to it, listen to it. And, you know, want to listen to the new artists whenever it's going on and just take everything for what it is.
That's how much he loved it. He then reclassified what he was saying in his original comments.
But, you know, what I was trying to say is that a lot of people, except for a handful of artists, are saying the same shit. They're not saying anything super meaningful. And I'm 22 years old. I have not had all the life experience in the world to talk about the most meaningful shit. I just sing about what I have gone through, what's going on in my life, and what I want to sing about. Never once did I say that I don't appreciate hip hop.
But it didn't really help. And the reason why it didn't help is because soon after this, Post would dig himself in a deeper hole by disrespecting hip-hop even more. You see, another reason why he's being accused of being a culture vulture is his unwillingness to label himself as a rapper. But this was before he made those statements. You see, in 2018, Post would actually double down on these statements in an interview with GQ when he was asked if he ever felt anxious working in a predominantly black genre. He said, "I definitely feel like there's a struggle being a white rapper, but I don't want to be a rapper. I just want to be a person that makes music. I make music that I like and I think kicks ass, that I think people who f*** with me as a person, as an artist, will like." Host may have thought this was smooth. However, for many people, this behavior showed a lack of commitment within the hip hop community. In an interview back in 2015, he literally said he wasn't a rapper.
I'm not a rapper. I'm an artist, you know, I don't make rap music. You know, I might rap, but I don't make rap music. I make, you know, I just make whatever I like. You can't really categorize it or put me in a box or anything, you know. I think it just comes out, you know what I mean? I don't want to call it a genre. I don't want to put myself anywhere that people want to put me in. I just want to be myself and, you know, keep working.
Now, saying you don't want to be boxed into a genre isn't really a big deal. However, in Post Malone's case, his rise in the industry with tracks like White Iverson sparked significant discussion. In White Iverson, Post Malone referred to a beloved black icon, Allen Iverson, while enjoying mainstream success that many black rappers struggled to attain by using a figure in their culture. But that's not all. Post Malone's infamous braids first came into the limelight when he released White Iverson, meaning he transformed his image and used elements of black culture to also blow up. You can clearly see that to him, the braids were just a part of the aesthetic.
Yeah, it's not even the hip hop culture. It's like, you know, the young culture, the young generation of people, you know, like, I mean, they get mad because I have braids, but, you know, I like the way it looks. They get mad because I got gold teeth or whatever. I like the way that it looks. You know, I'm not trying to bite off anybody or anything. I'm just trying to, I like it, you know.
When asked why he used Iverson as a reference, he said,
"Why was Iverson your influence?"
He's just cool, stepping over people and shaking Michael Jordan and everything. No, I don't remember. I never watched that, but I mean, I just watch videos all day.
He's just cool, but all right. So looking back, to many, it seemed like Post was just adopting elements from black culture for personal style and was simply picking and choosing what was convenient or trendy, which only reinforced the culture vulture narrative. But to make things worse, Post Malone also didn't really seem interested in supporting the culture he was taking from either. In the same interview with The Breakfast Club, Charlamagne Tha God suddenly confronted Post Malone about his contributions to the Black Lives Matter movement. Granted, it was an out of the blue question. Today, certain charities in that movement turned out to be very corrupt, and you can clearly see in the whole interview that Charlamagne was trying to push Post's buttons because he believed he was a culture vulture. But many still believed that Post was out of touch.
What are you doing for the Black Lives Matter movement?
What?
I don't know.
Is that a serious question?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry.
If anything.
I feel like, you know, and
he then brought up a story.
And that's funny too, actually, that you brought that up, because I have a song called Too Young.
Okay.
And you know, in Dallas, a kid named Christian Taylor, and you know, a week before that happened, you know, he tweeted the lyrics to my song, which was like, it was like prophetic.
What was the lyrics?
Crazy that he was listening to my song, you know, and he tweeted it, and it happened, you know. It's wild, and I don't know what to.
Lack of a clear response revealed a troubling disconnect. Instead of addressing the movement directly, he diverted the conversation to a personal story related to one of his songs. He further added that he would just keep making music to help the movement.
What does that have to do with Black Lives Matter?
Nothing. I'm just saying that's an instance of like that, you know.
He got killed by police.
Yeah.
Got you.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. I just think it's cool. And then people, you know, the news seen it and everybody seen it. So I don't know. I mean, I guess what I can do to help Black Lives Matter is I have to keep making music. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Got you.
I don't know.
I would have just said nothing.
I mean, honestly,
I would have just been like, nothing, you know, at the moment. You know, I'm trying to learn.
What's ironic is looking back, most would view Post rapping as hurting it, not helping. But what's crazy is that none of what I just spoke about is close to what Post Malone would do next to piss off hip hop fans even more. You see, by 2020, Post Malone's dominance began to drop. His music output slowed down, and when he did a return with new material, the reception just wasn't quite the same. His 2021 rap single, Motley Crue, directed by Cole Bennett, felt like a typical trap song, but failed to make any waves, which was a big sign that times were changing. In fact, throughout 2021 and 2022, Post Malone's collaborations flopped even more. Despite collaborating with big-name artists like The Weeknd and A$AP Rocky, his momentum slowed down big time. And it was clear that as hip-hop's grip on pop culture began to weaken, so would Post. Fast forward to 2024, and Post Malone had fully transitioned into making, wait for it, country music. Yup, you heard that right. Country music. He even headlined the country music festival Stagecoach and performed America the Beautiful at the Super Bowl. But to fans that have been paying attention, this shift wasn't entirely out of the blue. Post had been moving away from hip-hop for a while. In 2019, on his highly successful album, Hollywood's Bleeding, the most popular song was Circles, an alternative pop song. But what's clear throughout Post Malone's career is that no matter what you think or believe, here's what it looks like. It looks like he's a reflection of whatever's popular at the moment. When hip-hop was king, he was a rapper. When pop music resurged, he made an alternative pop album. Now that country's making waves, he's positioning himself as a country artist. To some, it's a survival tactic or an expression of himself. To others, or most, he's a culture vulture. Even Adam22 agreed that Post blatantly used hip-hop.
My problem with Post Malone is that, like, it looks like he used hip-hop right until the moment where he didn't need it anymore, and then he said, all right, f*** this shit. And then now he puts out a project, and I don't think you really, like, are gonna see a rapper on his next project, you know? Like, I don't think, like, he gets the Taylor, like, he's one of the only artists featured on the Taylor Swift album.
I was very curious why Post didn't even try to keep the act up.
Like, yeah, he's literally, like, gotten bigger than hip-hop, and I wish that he would
Wasn't
still...
Wasn't Ice Spice on there, too?
Bro, he should have a fucking 4Bat song on the next album, or he should have a Drake feature, or, like, just something. Like, he should keep his foot in the door to make it clear, yo, I wasn't just...
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Just culture vulturing you before.
What makes this all worse is the fact that hip-hop is far more open to outsiders than many other genres. For instance, Lil Nas X faced significant criticism when entering country music. To succeed, he needed the support of Billy Ray Cyrus to validate his hit, Old Town Road. When Beyonce dropped a country album, she was clowned for it. So, these black artists being rejected by country music shows how different genres treat cultural outsiders. But of course, what did Post Malone have to say after being called a culture vulture? Well, let's just say it wasn't great. In an interview with CBS Sunday Morning, Malone opened up about how these accusations, when he was so young, hurt him, and how it sent him into a deep depression.
How did that feel to you?
It sucked.
Yeah.
I was a kid.
19, 20. How did you deal with it?
Drink a lot.
Yeah. Did you take it personally? Because I
absolutely. It's hard not to.
And when he said drink a lot, he wasn't joking. He was really going through it.
4 years ago, I was on a rough path.
What were you wrestling with then?
Everything. It was terrible.
You were already really successful.
Yes, sir. Getting up, having a good cry,
yeah,
drinking, and then going, living your life, and then whenever you go lay down, drinking some more and having a good cry.
However, surprise, surprise, no one cared. Instead, hip-hop fans saw this as Post Malone not only stealing from the culture, but now victimizing himself, and trying to gain sympathy from the public by basically bashing them. And I'm sure you can already guess how that went. One fan wrote, Post Malone crying about being called a culture vulture is so funny because he literally came into the game with braids and a grill, made an album, then pooped on the genre before leaving to make country, LMAO. So clearly, no one felt any sympathy for Post. Poor guy. But you may be wondering, hey, there are plenty of other rappers who try their hand at other genres. What makes Post different? Well, the thing is, the trend of white artists using hip-hop as an entry point and then shifting to other genres has become very common these days. And when they do it, they usually leave the genre for good, which we'll go over later in this video.
No, because rap is an entry point. Mm-hmm. That's all. It's all it is. Mm-hmm. So they don't trick me with what's in the bio. It has to stay there.
Gotcha.
Because you'll lose us.
Yeah.
But what you go on to become... totally, totally, totally different.
However, some black artists like Travis Scott and Lil Uzi Vert lean into different genres like rock and alternative styles.
Okay, okay.
Uzi and Post lean into that.
Yeah.
Travis is still.
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of like his about his live show, the way that he turns up live and mosh presents pit, it live. It's mosh pit rockstar.
It's rockstar.
However, the difference between them and Post Malone is that they still have deeper connections to hip-hop than Post, because they're still rappers, while he drifted away from the genre entirely. And today, most hip-hop fans don't even think of Post as a rapper. They see him as a pop star.
Nobody calls Post Malone a rapper.
They don't. A lot of people do call
him. Absolutely, they do call him. Even, yeah, they do call him a rapper.
What they call Post Malone?
A rapper and singer. I never hear that.
I never heard that. Even his bio, I'm looking at it right now.
I don't care what I'm just saying. There.
Post Malone is referred to as a rapper, though.
Well, that's because he had the White Iverson, you idiots.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. White Iverson was hip hop, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they're right. But Post Malone obviously isn't the only white rapper to face scrutiny. Another person who faced just as much or even more throughout his career is Eminem. Despite being the best-selling rapper in history and being widely respected in the genre, Eminem's career has always been a weird roller coaster. By now, the hip-hop community knows that Eminem has been battle-tested. His reputation, credibility, and skills have been questioned and proven for decades. However, despite having one of the most long-lasting careers in music, what Eminem could never shake off were the culture vulture allegations. But is it justified, or is there more to the story? Well, ever since the beginning of his career, Eminem has always felt like he needed to justify his space in the genre.
Music is part image, but overall, music is not visual. You know what I'm saying? You hear music, you listen to music. When it boils down to it, it's what the person is saying. It's just, music is just like football or any sport. If you're good at it, you're good at it, and it don't care what color you are, what you look like, or nothing like that.
And that wasn't the only time M defended himself. In another interview from 1999, Eminem explained that one day, he would be seen as just a great rapper, not simply a white rapper.
I'm like this, to put a label on something, it kind of like disgusts me that it's 1999 and people still get labeled as white rapper. I just want to live to see the day that we don't put labels on anything.
He also tried to explain that we listen to music, not watch it. So he was confused on why he was being judged.
I want to live to see the day that I'm just a rapper. I'm just an artist. You listen to music. You don't watch music, you listen to it. Unless you're watching the video, of course. You see the image and everything is all part of the whole thing.
However, despite what you would like to think, Eminem isn't as innocent as you think. Because at one point in his career, Eminem was caught saying the word, if you catch my drift, leading to the question, how did the biggest white rapper in hip-hop history once get exposed for using the word and not have his career absolutely destroyed? Well, to understand that, we have to go back to the very beginning. In 2004. At this point, Eminem was at the top of his game and seemed untouchable. However, little did he know that that was all about to change. Because on the opposite side of this was a man named Benzino. Benzino was a rapper and one of the co-founders of The Source magazine, which was basically the most influential publication in hip-hop at the time, as well as respected. However, when Eminem dropped Marshall Mathers in 2000, which at the time was considered one of the best hip-hop albums ever, The Source gave it just 2 mics out of 5. Of course, fans were outraged, and the magazine eventually updated the score to 4 mics. But to M and his fans, the damage had already been done, and Eminem's relationship with The Source and Benzino quickly soured. So what does this have to do with racism? I'm getting to it. Eminem would diss Benzino and The Source in a song where he rapped, 5 mics in The Source ain't holding my breath, but I'll suffocate for the respect before I collect a check. And according to Benzino's partner, Dave Mays, co-founder of The Source, Benzino had a bit of a problem with Eminem. He thought Eminem was overhyped, especially because of his race, and that they didn't want another white Elvis situation in hip-hop, referring to how Elvis overshadowed black rock and roll artists back in the day. And while it kind of sounds like they were simply envious towards Eminem, the truth was that they did have a valid argument. And I can get further into the beef, but I'm just going to end it at this. Eminem absolutely destroyed Benzino in their back and forth between diss tracks. However, in a shocking turn of events, Benzino would pull out a trap card and reveal what hip-hop fans now refer to as the Racist Hour tapes, as it featured M spitting some seriously offensive and racist bars. In late 2003, Benzino and Dave Myers, his partner at The Source, held a press conference revealing what they called the Racist Hour tapes. And well, as you can predict with the name, these tapes were nothing short of scandalous. In these tapes are old recordings featuring a young Eminem making racist comments back in 1993.
We can hear the music now.
I'll get straight to the point. Black girls are bitches. That's why I'ma tell you, you better pull up your britches. Cause all that cash is making your ass drag from the boyfriend you gang. Black girls and white girls just don't mix, because black girls are dumb and white girls are good. White girls are good. I like white girls.
And of course, at that time, editing tools weren't as good as they are now. So no one even questioned whether it was M spitting these questionable bars. But it didn't stop there. Of course, Benzino went all out.
Black women are bad, white women are good. I don't care if he's redeemed himself now. That's not the message. And if that's who he is, then he has to be held accountable for that.
Fortunately for Eminem, one of his longtime friends and rapper, Bizarre, still backed him up, saying that these tapes were actually edited by The Source to make it sound like M was a racist.
The song was cut off and edited. He that song was, they was freestyling, they was naming all type of races, like, white girl, what you think about a white girl, black girl, a black girl, Bexy. But the source just edited the black girl part and made it like it was racist.
But that defense doesn't really cut it. And while you think that the misogynistic lyrics were the end of it, you'd be wrong. It gets so much worse than that. Because in another snippet, So Many Styles, Eminem was caught committing one of the biggest crimes against the culture a white rapper can commit. A white rapper saying the N-word. Now, a scandal of this caliber was sure to have ruined or probably ended anyone's career, especially if it happened in today's social and political climate. And this is where the narrative on how privileged Eminem really is within the hip-hop world takes shape. During this time, Benzino argued that Eminem had been hiding these racist views all along, and he compared M's situation to the other public scandals involving black personalities like Mike Tyson and Kobe Bryant, where they were not treated equally to the public's outrage, and were basically seen as guilty almost from the start. But of course, Eminem and his camp needed to conduct damage control as soon as they could. So days after the scandal, Eminem issued a public apology where he explained that he recorded Foolish Pride when he was just 17 years old and was feeling bitter at the time, stating, "Ray Benzino and David Mays and The Source have had a vendetta against me, Shady Records, and our artists for a long time. The tape they played today was something I made out of anger, stupidity, and frustration when I was a teenager, and I had just broken up with my girlfriend, who was African American, and I reacted like the stupid, angry kid I was. I hope people will take it for the foolishness that it was, and not for what somebody is trying to make it into today." But a broken heart still does not justify him or anyone using racial slurs. Nothing should. He then tried to explain that this was The Source's last shot at staying relevant. Dave Mays and Benzino are spitting in the face of what hip-hop and rap music have done to promote racial unity. Their attempt to use this old, foolish recording to damage me.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityChiro.com. That's AbilityChiro.com.
And in turn, the positivity that hip-hop promotes is really nothing more than the blatant self-promotion for a failing magazine and one man's lifeless music career. They're scared of what can happen if the hip-hop community shows it can live without them. And when it comes to So Many Styles snippet, where M was allegedly caught saying the N-word, his manager, Paul Rosenberg, claimed they had never heard of it before, but still tried to stop The Source from releasing it, which raised many eyebrows. But the craziest part of all this to me is instead of destroying Eminem's career, this aggressive campaign backfired. The Source took a massive hit from the Benzino vs. Eminem beef. Record labels like Interscope pulled their advertising from the magazine, which largely affected the revenue. And by 2005, Benzino was forced to step down from The Source, saying that his feud with Eminem was one of the main reasons. Eminem wasn't left with a scratch. Benzino is half Puerto Rican and half black. If you didn't know, Puerto Ricans and black Americans started hip-hop. And it goes without saying that Eminem is white. But unfortunately for Eminem, and I guess fortunately for Benzino, the critics didn't stop there. Because just as recently as 2022, he faced accusations of cultural appropriation for an old music video. And the video in question was the 2004 music video for My Band by D12. In this video, Eminem can be seen in a matador outfit while his group members are dressed like a mariachi band. But that wasn't what he was canceled for, because in his last verse, Eminem mimicked a Mexican accent, rapping, "My salsa makes all the pretty girls want to dance and get in their pants." So why did an almost 20-year-old video suddenly resurface? Well, it started with another fellow rapper, Tyga, who was involved in a similar controversy after releasing his 2022 music video for Ay Caramba. Now, Tyga faced immediate backlash from the Mexican community for these stereotypes, leading to Tyga's apology. However, it also sparked questions about why Eminem, who did something similar in My Band, escaped scrutiny for so long. Why had Eminem been protected from the harsh criticism that other black artists like Tyga have faced and get a pass when artists like Tyga don't? I guess I'll have to let you answer that. And this is a perfect segue into the next point in the video, white rappers and their white privilege. So white privilege in hip hop is a conversation that often gets pushed aside, but remains prominent in the discussion about race and music. As you just saw with Post Malone and Eminem, it's blatant and has been a thing in hip hop for a while. But there's one example of white privilege that takes the cake, and that is Macklemore's controversial win over Kendrick Lamar at the 2014 Grammy Awards. And as messed up as it is to say this, it almost beautifully encapsulates white privilege, and hip-hop. So let me set the stage for you. The 2014 Grammy Awards were supposed to be a night of love and celebration of music and culture, and the night was billed to be among the most eventful awards that year, seeing that 2 out of 4 members of the Beatles perform on stage, Kendrick Lamar and Imagine Dragons, Good Kid, Mad City, and Radioactive mashup performance was absolutely electrifying, and a certain white rapper who had done quite commercially, Macklemore, performed with Madonna and Queen Latifah. So it's safe to say it was an awesome night for music lovers of all types. However, it ended very differently. So remember Macklemore? Well, that year he dropped an album titled The Heist, which was his debut studio album, and it's safe to say it did really well. The album's single, Thrift Shop, took over the pop and hip-hop charts. The song stayed on the charts for more than 20 weeks and peaked at number 1 on its 16th week, and it would remain on top for 6 non-consecutive weeks. And because of its success, Macklemore was nominated for multiple Grammys. And when the night came, Macklemore brought home a total of 4 awards: Best New Artist, Best Rap Performance for Thrift Shop, and Best Rap Song for the same song. However, the 4th and most important award Macklemore got for the night would be the same one that would earn him major controversies for years to come: Best Rap Album. The thing is, virtually no one in the hip-hop community expected him to win this. I mean, just take a look at the albums Macklemore had to beat for the award. You have Drake's Nothing Was the Same, Kanye West's Yeezus, Jay-Z's Magna Carta, a holy grail of albums already. And of course, Kendrick's Lamar, Good Kid, Mad City. While you can make the argument that The Heist had a better chance of winning against Drake, Kanye, and Jay-Z's albums, the entire hip-hop community, even Macklemore himself, knew that Kendrick's Good Kid, Mad City should have won the album. We're up against Kendrick, who made a phenomenal album. If we win a Grammy for Best Rap Album, hip-hop is going to be heated in terms of that category. I think it should go to Kendrick, Macklemore said before the awards. But yet, as fate would have it, Macklemore's The Heist won the award. And as soon as he took to the stage to receive the trophy, everybody in the hip-hop community went in a frenzy. The incident was such a mess that the Recording Academy knew it. If you look up videos of the moment when Macklemore and Ryan Lewis took to the stage to receive the award, you'll have a very hard time finding the video. It's almost as if any footage has been scrubbed to prevent further discourse. But of course, this tactic did not work. Everyone witnessed the Grammy snub Kendrick's Good Kid, Mad City for the award, an album deemed as a hip-hop classic as soon as it was released, and the album everyone believed had every right to win the Best Rap Album of the year. To add to this, seeing as how the Best Rap Album award was won by a white artist when a black artist clearly deserved it, this also fueled the discussion surrounding white artists in hip-hop and how they benefit from white privilege, whether they like it or not. Now, before we proceed with the discussion, I know there is a vast majority of music fans who don't treat the Grammys seriously anymore. These days, the Grammys are seen as more of a marketing and industrial ceremony rather than a celebration of music and artistry as a whole. To be honest, they never were. However, back then, social media hadn't taken over as much, and the Grammys were still very much a big deal. So this was a major talking point. From discourses such as the Grammys are racist to the Grammys don't know anything about hip-hop, the main discussion was that white privilege in hip-hop remains true after all these years. On one hand, you had The Heist, which was carried by Thrift Shop. I can't play it because of copyright. And on the other hand, there was Kendrick Lamar's Good Kid, Mad City, which was simply better when it came to soundscape, lyrics, storytelling, cadence, cultural impact, themes, and defining the genre. But despite all of that, the Grammys only looked at The Heist numbers and said, yep, that's the winner right there. However, there was also one factor that seemed to have helped Macklemore trend and become more viral in the months leading up to the Grammys, which was that he was seen yet again as the next white boy in hip hop. It also didn't help that the Grammy Awards is solely based on ballot voting from a panel that is mostly white, or was mostly white. Macklemore even acknowledged it. In terms of the people that are voting on the album, that are filling out those bubbles, we had an unfair advantage due to race. This is not like a rap radar poll. This is the Grammys. There's many different types of people, all different age groups, filling out a ballot where they might not necessarily know the drama. Nonetheless, when Macklemore's The Heist won over Kendrick Lamar's Good Kid, Mad City, as well as over Drake, Kanye, and Jay-Z's albums that year, people saw this as an attack on hip-hop culture as a whole, and they decided they needed to do something about it. So as expected, the ordeal didn't end there. Macklemore himself was so distraught about Kendrick's Grammy snub that he personally texted him to apologize for the situation. In his text, Macklemore candidly addressed the elephant in the room.
You got robbed. I wanted you to win. You should have. It's weird and sucks that I robbed you. I was gonna say that during the speech. Then the music started playing during my speech and I froze. Anyway, you know what it is.
He uploaded this text message on Instagram along with the caption, "He deserved Best Rap Album. I'm honored and completely blown away to win anything, much less 4 Grammys. But in that category, he should have won in my opinion. And that's taking nothing away from the heist, just giving Good Kid Mad City its proper respect. However, this decision would backfire against Macklemore. For one, this post got mixed reactions by fans. Some believed that Macklemore was just trying to play it safe, being humble and all, while some believed he was being sincere. What do you think? Besides, even before the awards, Macklemore had already acknowledged that Kendrick deserved the award. Perhaps he truly did feel remorseful that he got the award instead of Kendrick. So what did Kendrick have to say about this? Well, while Macklemore didn't post Kendrick's response, if he didn't send any, Kendrick did speak publicly on how he felt about the whole thing with Macklemore winning the award and how he apologized to him after.
When he sent it to me, I was like, okay, you know, I could see him feeling that type of way because he's a good dude, but I think for confirmation from the world, you know, he probably felt like he had to put it out there, which he didn't need to do. He didn't need to do, but that don't take nothing away from him anyway, because I know where his heart is at, he cool. He a cool dude, but, you know, sometimes the car folds like that when you...
But not everyone agreed with Macklemore's response. Among those who didn't exactly like the fact that Macklemore apologized to Kendrick after the Grammys was none other than fellow nominee, Drake. While speaking to the Rolling Stones, Drake aired out his thoughts on the entire debacle, basically saying that Macklemore was whack for even apologizing to Kendrick for winning the Grammy. I was like, you won. Why are you posting your text message? Just chill, take the W, and if you feel like you didn't deserve it, go get better, make better music, Drake said. To him, it wasn't genuine. It felt cheap. It didn't feel genuine. Why do that? Why feel guilt? You think those guys would pay homage to you if you won? And he kinda had a point, but at the same time, not really. But going back to what happened to Macklemore after this whole event transpired, this is one of the few times you could say there was some sort of justice in the complicated issue of race in hip-hop. Because after this moment, Macklemore tried his hardest to right his wrongs, constantly speaking about his privilege in interviews, saying stuff like, in terms of hip-hop culture, what am I giving to the culture? How am I participating in an authentic way that is actually giving something to the culture and not just taking from it? He said, that's a question that as a white rapper, I need to constantly be asking myself. That's a question I've been asking myself a long time and will continue to for the rest of my career. What am I actually giving and what am I taking? And how can I better this culture? Dropping songs to address it, like White Privilege 2 and more. But after that, everything he released flopped terribly. And today, Macklemore has completely fallen off. But besides Macklemore, white rappers like G-Eazy and Jack Harlow have also spoken about or acknowledged their white privilege. In an interview, G-Eazy told ABC News Live, as a white person in hip-hop, now, I get to contribute to a culture that I grew up in and that I have a great love and respect for. And I'm very appreciative.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
And grateful for, like, all that I've gone to do in the space. On the other hand, according to Jack Harlow, in an interview with the Footwear News, he had finally understood the privilege he had being a white man in today's hip-hop scene, saying, I feel blessed to have a voice in this period because, one, I'm not a street artist, and two, I'm not black. The only thing keeping me here right now is that level of authenticity of being myself. But the truth is, regardless of them acknowledging their privilege or not, it doesn't change anything. Artists like G-Eazy, Macklemore, Jack Harlow, and more have had insanely successful careers in hip-hop. Unfortunately, this success is usually quick. White rappers like Macklemore and G-Eazy can enjoy a short burst of mainstream success, but they rarely maintain long-term relevance in the hip-hop scene since they're quickly replaced by the next white rapper that appeals to what's trending or for the new generation of white audiences, which is an example of how white privilege in hip-hop can also backfire against white artists themselves. The thing is, some white artists are actually aware of this, and rather than stay in the realm of hip-hop, they decide to jump ship early or in the middle of their career.
No, because rap is an entry point. Mm-hmm. That's all. It's all it is. Mm-hmm. So they don't trick me with what's in the bio. It has to stay there.
Gotcha.
Because you'll lose us.
Yeah.
But what you go on to become, totally, totally, totally different.
Take Lil Dicky, for instance. Lil Dicky is a white rapper known for his humor, mixing comedy, and clever lyricism in his songs. Through a relatively unique type of presentation, Lil Dicky found a way to make a name for himself in the hip-hop world. However, despite portraying a persona of being nice and likable, Lil Dicky has been a perpetrator of the same continuous problem that the black community has called many non-black artists out. namely using the clout and power of rap music to further their own careers. So let's dive in. In the case of Lil Dicky, as much as he wanted to be respected in the hip-hop community, it didn't help his case when he admitted that he used the genre as a stepping stone to comedy and launched his TV show, Dave, prompting him to not release a single record for 9 years.
That I guess I've always kind of thought that I was meant to be something, like from an entertainer perspective. And the first thing that, you know, like when class clown in middle school, high school, like the feedback was generally like, you're a funny person.
Yeah.
So the reason I started rapping was to get to be noticed as a comedic presence. Like I started rapping because of that purpose.
And honestly, no matter how nice Lil Dicky sounded, the fact is that what he did was a textbook definition of being a culture vulture. You see, over the years, Lil Dicky has garnered the respect and love of television, as proven by the success of Dave. Unfortunately, the same cannot be said about his relationship with the hip-hop community. This was proven by the fact that when he tried to come back into the rap scene by releasing the soundtrack for Dave called Penneth, fans wrote it off as another blatant attempt at culture vulturing, and it sold 16K in the first week. And just a footnote, this is kind of similar to what Post Malone did, but with country music instead of like a TV show. But speaking of country music, one of the biggest problems when it comes to white rappers who are clearly appropriating hip hop rather than appreciating it is when they abandon their musical roots and immediately switch genres after becoming famous. While there are many white rappers who show genuine love and respect for the game that are also mostly respected by the community, we've also seen artists such as Post Malone, Machine Gun Kelly, and G-Eazy leave the scene as soon as they reach the top. But we've already spoken about Posty. Another white rapper that started out in hip-hop but eventually left is Machine Gun Kelly, although he may have left the genre for an entirely different reason. MGK earned relative success during his early years in the music industry as a rapper. He released a handful of tracks and mixtapes before being signed to a major record label, and he has collaborated with major hip-hop artists such as DMX, Waka Flocka, and Wiz Khalifa. His albums were commercially successful, and no matter how you feel about him, MGK was recognized in the world of hip-hop. In time though, MGK's music slowly shifted towards a more punk rock sound. After his beef with Eminem and his fourth studio album, Hotel Diablo, had more of a rock rapish sound, and the album after that completely let go of the hip-hop sound. MGK's fifth studio album, Tickets to My Downfall, was a complete departure from his hip-hop roots. It was more of a punk rock album. In fact, Blink-182's drummer, Travis Barker, acted as both the recording drummer and the producer for the album. And just like Post Malone, MGK had an explanation for why he switched genres too. Growing up, Machine Gun Kelly always loved rock as much as he loved hip-hop, as not only were Eminem and DMX his hip-hop idols, but so were Guns N' Roses and Blink-182 as major inspirations for him musically. So according to him, his shift to punk rock wasn't all that surprising. Another interesting detail to note is that while MGK's album numbers from 2012 to 2019 weren't bad, it had been evidently declining since his debut. However, when MGK released his punk rock album, Tickets to My Downfall, he achieved nearly similar numbers compared to the sales he received from his debut album, including a gold certification from RIAA. So it's entirely possible that MGK wanted to shift his sound because he knew his hip-hop career was declining, so he turned to the other genre he was passionate about. Of course, many believe it was because Eminem destroyed him in a rap beef. Fortunately for MGK, him losing to Eminem kind of gave him an excuse for switching genres, so people don't really pin him as a culture vulture, but more of a wuss. But MGK will still drop a rap song here and there, so it's not that bad, in my opinion. Still bad though. However, MGK is not the only prominent white hip-hop artist to switch genres. Another example of this phenomenon is the one and only Vanilla Ice. You see, when his music hit the mainstream, Vanilla Ice became one of the biggest names in hip-hop. However, along with his rise in fame, the pushback from the black hip-hop community also got stronger. But he didn't see why. To him, he was just doing what he loved, and he was happy that his success was bringing more of an audience to the world of hip-hop.
KRS-One said that you present a distorted mutation of rap. What is that? I'm not sure what that means.
I have no idea what it meant. I read the same article. They also said that, you know, I'm bringing rap music to an audience that has never heard it before as well. So, you know.
Wow, very noble. So as you just saw, Ice immediately shrugged off the criticism of fellow rapper KRS-One and refocused the conversation on the positive thing the article said about him.
Whether I like it or not, it's bringing rap music up, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm putting it in front of people that never even considered listening to rap music.
Yeah.
And now they're considering it, and it's bringing rap music up.
So while Ice didn't understand the problem at large, his producers, managers, and basically the executives that were bankrolling his career definitely knew what they were doing. They saw Ice as a lucrative commodity, and they also knew that Ice was a white person in a black-dominated genre. So in an effort to make the hip-hop community embrace him, they created a false autobiography of Vanilla Ice to give him more street credibility, titled Ice by Ice. Many of the fake claims in this autobiography would later be debunked by Ice himself. But things weren't going to stay this way forever. A few years after the success of his debut single, Ice's career would begin to decline. He released his sophomore album 4 years later, and the album would be a stark contrast from his first album. It didn't chart at all, and it also failed commercially. Afterwards, the hip-hop community rejected Vanilla Ice's career from then on, and without another hit like Ice Ice Baby to ride on, he left hip-hop to pursue a career as a metal artist. And while Ice's time in hip-hop was controversial to say the least, he did more than just make hip-hop popular with Ice Ice Baby. You see, in 1991, Suge Knight, along with Mario Chocolate Johnson and a linebacker for the Los Angeles Raiders, apparently dropped by, unannounced, into Ice's suite at the Bel Age Hotel. They then bullied him into giving up the publishing rights for Ice Ice Baby over to Suge by doing some, let's just say, not very nice things to him on the balcony. While Ice claims that that's not how it happened and that it was less dramatic than that. The fact of the matter is that Ice did give up 50% of the track's royalties to Suge, which helped him fund and found Death Row Records. So in a way, Ice's brief time in hip-hop helped create the label that would popularize some of the biggest names in hip-hop like Snoop Dogg and Tupac. But switching genres is actually a part of a larger problem that hip-hop has with white rappers. The fact that to many, they're considered tone-deaf. And to illustrate that, there's no better example than Post Malone's infamous interview with Charlamagne Tha God on The Breakfast Club. If you haven't seen it, Charlamagne went in on Post Malone due to what everyone assumed was because of his race. So for context, this interview took place right after Post Malone blew up with his hit single White Iverson, propelling Post to become the newest white rapper face in hip hop. And Charlamagne didn't like that one bit.
What's your name, soldier?
Post Malone.
Post Malone! One of my young boys, Relly on Smash, put me on to your record.
Yeah.
Yeah, White Iverson.
Yeah.
I played it on my TV show, Uncommon Sense.
How'd it go?
So, and I'm glad that you're tall.
Okay.
Because you do a lot of basketball references. So I was saying, I hope that he's tall, and I hope that he, at one point in his life, played basketball.
So as you can see, from the very start, Charlamagne was questioning Post's authenticity. When Charlamagne asked Post if it was difficult being a white rapper, Post gave this calm, almost rehearsed answer. He said,
is it difficult to be a quote-unquote white rapper?
I don't think it's difficult. I think everybody has their opinion on white rappers or whatever, you know, being, you know, against the norm, you know what I mean?
And right there, Post was acknowledging that white rappers are always viewed through a different lens. People are constantly wondering if they're genuine or just culture vultures. And let's be real, Post Malone has faced a lot of criticism. But remember when we spoke about why white rappers like Post Malone often get labeled as culture vultures? Well, one of the reasons was that they have trouble acknowledging or fully respecting the culture's origins. And that's where Post Malone starts getting into trouble. At one point in this interview, Charlamagne asked Post if he's worried about being labeled a culture vulture. And Post responded,
Are you afraid as a white rapper that you may be considered a culture vulture?
I don't think so. I'm not scared. I'm not scared because I'm not trying to be anybody that I'm not.
True indeed.
I'm just trying to, you know, I like what I like. And I don't think I'm biting off of a certain culture or copying a certain culture or trying to be part of a certain culture because, you know, I like what I like.
And while that sounds like a fair answer, it's still kind of sidestepping the deeper issue. Being genuine is great, but Charlotte...
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Charlamagne probably wanted to hear something more than just, I'm being myself. But he wouldn't stop there. Charlamagne then added more fuel to the fire by bringing up white privilege. He straight up told Post Malone,
it's going to be a lot of white privilege questions that you're going to get soon.
No, yeah.
They're going to be like, oh, you only got signed because you're white. That's coming.
And Post, he brushed it off with a joke about being an industry plant.
I'm an industry plant.
You are?
Yeah.
An industry plant?
Yeah.
What's that mean?
I don't know. That's what they call me.
Listen, go with it.
And would further deflect on the topic by literally saying, I don't know nothing. I mean, I guess it's a funny way to deflect the question, but at the same time, it's not the response that people want when they're questioning your place in hip hop.
Yeah, for real, that's how I said.
You don't know what it means. Listen to what I'm telling you. When they say that you're only here because of white privilege, you're like, probably, but I make good music.
I don't know. That's all.
I don't know nothing. That's it. My boy Wax always says that. I don't know nothing. Just be like, I don't know. It's a good answer for everything.
Yeah.
But things would eventually calm down when they spoke about music again. Post Malone mentioned that he listens to a lot of old country music, like Garth Brooks and Toby Keith.
What do you listen to, Post? What do you listen to? What influences you?
Well, I listen to everything, you know, like I listen to a lot of old country.
Country.
That's what I listen to right now.
Okay.
And Future and Thug.
Country, Future, and Thug.
He was trying to explain that he was influenced by different genres, but Charlamagne just wasn't having it. And considering his shift in music recently, this is kind of ironic. So Charlamagne's grilling of Post Malone fits more into this deeper conversation about who gets to participate in hip hop and on what terms. Was he harsh? Yes. But was he also bringing up some valid concerns? And some of what he said, yes. In the end, Post Malone survived the interview, but it's clear that the questions about his place in hip hop haven't gone away. In fact, they've probably only gotten stronger. However, Post and Charlamagne's engagement didn't end there. Fast forward to the second interview and, well, it's deja vu. In the first interview, Charlamagne was seen as a hater, and the vibe was super awkward. This time around, well, it wasn't much different. And honestly, I gotta give him props for even coming on a second time. One of the first things Charlamagne did was try to sabotage Post Malone's friendship with Justin Bieber, which was kind of funny and kind of weird.
We've had some fun times with Justin Bieber.
Yeah, he got mad girls in the studio.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Mad drugs, mad alcohol.
You never been over
there? Oh, in the studio?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I mean, not really.
He even took another shot at Post's relationship with his girlfriend again, like he was trying to start something.
You never been in the studio with him with a bunch of girls?
No, yeah. I mean, not really.
He's trying to make his girlfriend mad at him or something. Is that what this is about?
It begins again. It begins again.
But then Charlamagne came right out again by telling Post he's been accused of cultural appropriation.
Okay. Because you always get accused of cultural appropriation.
Yeah, man.
But you don't ever feed into it, so to speak.
They put that video up of you from back in the day.
Yeah, you was like dancing in underwear or something, right?
No, those are my Chuck Norris action shorts.
Chuck Norris action shorts.
Post kind of shrugs it off, but you can tell there's tension. They dive into the topic a bit deeper, with Post explaining how he loves hip-hop, but also mentions that he wants to do country music in the future.
The whole cultural appropriation thing, like, you did get popping because of hip-hop.
Right.
But then you said you want to do country now.
I mean, I want to do country down the line. Okay. I'm still in the phase. I'm young. I'm having fun. I'm making the music that I like to make. Mm-hmm. And I'm just having fun with it right now.
So once again, looking back, clearly there were always signs that Post Malone was going to switch genres. And his next line of dialogue will foreshadow it even more. Because when asked about what kind of artist he is, Post responded,
"What kind of artist do you consider yourself?"
Just an artist, I guess. I feel like there's way too much boxing of genres. I feel like you should be able to make the music that you like, and if your fans like it, then you know that's dope. If they don't, then
it's
interesting, because you tried something new.
Not really helping his case with the whole culture vulture claims with that one. But he also pointed out that the critics and social media have flaws too.
I think that's what's wrong with social media nowadays too. People are so opinionated. And people have way too much to say, and everybody's so smart, and everybody's a critic. Everybody knows everything.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, just, like, if you don't know the situation, don't speak on it.
The topic then shifted to Post's dad, who worked at the Dallas Cowboys office. And as if things couldn't get more awkward, Charlamagne straight up told Post that he won't come to watch a game with them, because he thinks Post smells like cigarettes and beer. I mean, Post laughed it off, but you can tell Charlamagne's comments were not sitting well with them.
No, I don't dislike you, but I don't like the smell of beer and cigarettes. Post. And Post Malone smells like every beer and every cigarette that's in whatever convenience store in New York City right now.
I only smoke Camels though right now, so. I don't smell like no.
And to add even more heat, Charlamagne even said that Post Malone is like the new Kid Rock.
It's the new Kid Rock right here, ladies.
That's a loaded comment for sure, and you'll find out who Kid Rock is later in this video. So to save the interview, Post tried to steer the conversation towards politics, which probably wasn't the best idea.
Tell me more. Because you're young and you got a voice, I would like to know your thoughts on the current system.
Well, I mean, I think it's crazy. I think that neither of our candidates were fit to be, you know, where they are. Mm-hmm. I feel like.
Do you feel one was more
I honestly feel like, you know.
They also touched on racism for a bit, and you can tell Post is trying to say the right things. And you can see that he has no idea what he's talking about. I mean, he even admitted so himself.
Do you feel like seeds of racism were planted in a generation that wasn't even thinking about it?
I think that it's there, and I think that there's a lot of crazy stuff going on in this world right now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where it came from. I was born in 1995.
Right.
But, you know, I think there's some crazy stuff, and we need to really come together as humans and make shit right.
For example, when asked about what he'll do when he experiences racism, Post answered,
"What do you do when you experience racism? Like, meaning that you're around some white people who may be being racist. How do you
I don't hang out with racists.
That you know.
You don't experience that.
I haven't been in a situation where something has happened and they have been racist or, gotcha. Or anything like that.
And to wrap the disrespect up, Charlamagne admitted that he hadn't even heard Post mixtape.
His album is out right now. It's Stony. Called Stony.
Yeah, Stony.
And this is his debut album, by the way. So, you know, you've heard the mixtapes and everything. Mm-hmm.
Did you listen to it?
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. I might, though.
What do you mean, absolutely? You might like it. You might like it.
I might, though. Somebody did recommend it. I'm lying. But I'm going to listen to it.
He got to listen to it. He has.
But despite Charlamagne's antics throughout the interview, Post just took it calmly, which is impressive considering how much shade was thrown his way. But you might be wondering, hey, Charlamagne has interviewed plenty of white rappers before, and while he hasn't been super nice to them, just check out his interview with Logic. If you know, you know. He wasn't as tough as he was on Post. So what made Charlamagne hate Post Malone so much? Well, for one, there was comments he made on hip-hop about it not being able to evoke emotions to make one cry, but also a controversy where he said the N-word. You see, in 2015, Post found himself in a well-deserved controversy after an old video resurfaced showing himself saying the N-word. White rappers using the N-word has been a recurring issue, and it rarely ends well for those who do. Just take a look what happened to California rapper V Nasty, where she basically demanded her right to use the word during her short period of fame back in 2011. V Nasty faced immense criticism when she claimed her upbringing around black people gave her the right to use the word, and that moment quickly derailed her career. And the same could have happened to Post Malone. In a now deleted Vine, Post was seen watching a show called Too Cute with a friend before panning the camera to himself, saying, "And yeah, I'm not even going to show you the video." When the video resurfaced of Post casually dropping the N-word while watching TV with a friend, the reaction was fast. Fans and critics called him out, forcing Post to address the situation head on. And Post would quickly apologize on DJ Drama's Gangsta Girls Radio, saying, "It's an old video, you know, but it's acceptable and I made a mistake. I just want to apologize. I guess that's really it. I can't really say nothing. It was wrong with me." However, the damage was already done, and it only added fuel to the flame that he was just another white artist taking advantage of black culture. However, to really understand why white rappers deemed as culture vultures boil certain people's blood so much, such as Charlamagne, we have to go back to the roots. The term culture vulture in hip-hop stems from the fear that what Elvis did to rock and roll in the 50s will happen to the genre now. Because if you didn't know, Elvis Presley is the undeniable GOAT of culture vultures. And in the world of hip-hop, the artist who got closest to being an Elvis-like figure in the community was Eminem. Ironically, Eminem himself was aware that he was reaching a status where he could be considered the Elvis of hip-hop. So when fans classify Eminem as the king of rap, it's very similar to when Elvis was dubbed as the king of rock and roll. Of course, it's a small minority of fans who say this. Most would say it's Jay-Z or Nas or Lil Wayne, or really not Eminem. It's kind of crazy to say he's the king of rap. But just Eminem being in the conversation is enough of a threat for many. And when artists like Post Malone get so large that they begin to near the top spot in hip-hop, black hip-hop fans feel threatened. The crazy thing is many people believe that one day white rappers will be the face of rap. But don't take my word for it, take Jay-Z's, who said he had seen the future of hip-hop and said it was white, saying, "I don't have a problem with that. Rap is the music of youth, and yeah, most of the fans are white. They're going to be the next crop of artists. It's already happening. But to me, music doesn't have a color. I would not be surprised if in a few years the biggest rappers are white." But other hip-hop legends like Ice Cube remain more skeptical, saying, "Not only is it music driven by the youth, it's a music driven by the street and by the black culture. The lingo is always changing, and that lingo comes from the bottom of the ghetto. The reason that won't change is I don't think the white experience in America is as interesting as the black experience in this country. Art comes from the worst conditions, and that's why." He's not alone, though. Another rapper named Scarface said this, "Hip-hop is hip-hop, and it ain't going anywhere. You know what I mean? The face might change in 25 years. You know, hip-hop's gonna be white in 25 years. It's gonna be all white kids. No more. It's gonna be like rock and roll. To find a Ghetto Boys record in 25 years is gonna be rare. Some of you don't even believe that. You better f***ing believe it." But guess what? That Jay-Z.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
The interview was from the year 2000, so it looks like Ice Cube was correct. However, what remains true is that white rappers have it much easier. And to help you take a look at that, let's take a look at hip-hop's greatest culture vulture ever, Kid Rock. Kid Rock has a very complicated history with hip-hop and black culture. While some white rappers have been accused of leeching off of black culture, Kid Rock is someone who took it to a different level. The thing is, people these days just think of Kid Rock as a guy with a cowboy hat waving an American flag, but that's not how Kid Rock started. What most fans don't know is he actually started as a rapper. So let me share you the story of, in my opinion, hip-hop's biggest culture vulture, Kid Rock, starting from the very beginning. In Kid Rock's early years, he was inspired by rap groups like Run DMC and, of course, the Beastie Boys. So he began copying their style of music, and by the late 1980s, he had decided he wanted a career in hip-hop. Keep in mind that Kid Rock grew up rich. So how does a rich white kid from the suburbs break into hip-hop? He realized he needed connections, and this is where his family's wealth came in. Kid Rock started befriending the right people, one being a man named DJ Blackman, a local DJ in Detroit who took Kid Rock under his wing. In return, DJ Blackman introduced Kid Rock to the hip-hop scene and brought him into a group of local artists named the Beast Crew. According to an interview with Blackman,
"Helped Kid Rock assist him in growing as an artist. I did that from the bottom of my heart, man, you know. You know, I was trying to teach the guy what to do and what not to do, you know, because we had an agreement that we was going to do this thing, you know, and get the money and go ahead and make some art and it helped the rest of the crew, it helped the rest of the people that helped us, you know, but it never got to that."
Little did he know that this decision would backfire against the culture. By the way, just a side note, Kid Rock wasn't just rich, he was filthy rich, and you'll get what I mean when I explain it to you. Now, when you think of Detroit, you probably picture a tough city with some rundown buildings and some of the country's worst unemployment and divorce rates. And that was the life that Kid Rock claimed to have experienced early on. However, this was all a facade. The fact was that Kid Rock didn't grow up in the desolate and rundown parts of Detroit, but in the suburbs. But that's not where it ends, because he actually grew up in way more than just a little comfortable. Living in a mansion with 7 bathrooms, tennis courts, hot tubs, and more privileges than most can imagine to ever achieve. So clearly, his family wasn't even in the middle class. They were loaded. But back to how Kid Rock finessed people from the culture he was about to steal from to get an in into hip-hop. You see, it wasn't just DJ Blackman who would acknowledge Kid Rock. T-Bone, a member of the Beast Crew, explained how Kid Rock first caught their attention. According to him, they met Kid Rock at a party in Michigan and were impressed by his DJ skills.
"Rock, we met him in Mount Clemens, like I said, Mount Clemens, Michigan, at a party. We let him get on the turntables. He turned the party out. He was a hell of a DJ. We brought him back to Detroit after that. 6th and Gratiot area. You know, I gotta shout some streets out for Detroit."
And from that point on, Kid Rock was vouched for and mentored by black artists in Detroit as a promising young talent. However, unfortunately for these artists, Kid Rock had other ideas. Because once Kid Rock's career started to take off, he ditched the people who had helped him. And Blackman later spoke about how hurt he was when Kid Rock betrayed him and cut ties with them.
"I felt that it was over because now you feel right. That you got everything that you need. You're not coming around like you was coming around."
But Kid Rock didn't just leave his group, he even tried to ruin them. Chamtown, a rapper who claimed to have taught Kid Rock everything he knew about rap, claimed Kid Rock blocked them from getting deals of their own.
"So he's in New York without us. They asked him about Chamtown, he dissed the shit, then said, not me first, not him. That's what the A&R guy told us."
But you want to know why he did this? Well, hilariously enough, the reason why Kid Rock left and betrayed his group was because he thought he could make it on his own as a rapper. The thing is, this was in the early 90s, a time when Vanilla Ice had just blown up with Ice Ice Baby, and record labels were thirsty for their next white rapper. So Kid Rock had a chance. So he submitted a demo tape to Jive Records, and after taking a quick look at Kid Rock, they thought they had their next Vanilla Ice. And at 18 years old, Kid Rock landed his first record deal, releasing his debut album, Grit Sandwiches for Breakfast, where he toured with rappers like Too Short and Ice Cube to promote his album.
"It was an opening act. Here you are, a white boy with the high top fade, and probably a lot of people in the crowd, you know, they came to see Too Short and NWA. Probably the whole crowd wasn't even there yet. And motherfuckers like, what's this white boy up there doing? That probably like molded him into the Kid Rock he is now."
Unfortunately for him, he wasn't successful. Because as a form of karmic justice, Kid Rock's album flopped and Jive eventually dropped him from the label.
"I thought my big break was with Jive, RCA, and then working with Too Short and D-Nice, and then touring with Ice Cube and Too Short. And then, you know, I came home from all that and I got dropped and I had like $2,200 in my pocket. So I went right to the music store and bought a piece of equipment. I was broke again."
But instead of growing up, Kid Rock did what any culture vulture would have done. He jumped ship. Kid Rock started to mix rock into his hip-hop sound, and for some reason, it worked. And that's where things would go downhill for Kid Rock, specifically his persona. You see, Kid Rock started in hip-hop back in the early 90s, when the genre was gaining popularity massively. However, as soon as rock and nu metal started to blow up in the mid to late 90s, Kid Rock jumped ship. While he still rapped on some tracks, Stalin was mostly rock and country. People started to see the change, not just in his music, but also in his audience. His crowds were predominantly white, and this shift was no accident. Kid Rock had consciously decided to distance himself from the black artists and communities that had helped him start his career in the first place. So fast forward to the early 2000s, and Kid Rock had completely abandoned hip-hop and started adopting a completely opposite image. What's worse is that he even admitted that he used rap and black culture to start his career. Initially, I had to do the rap rock thing and all that because I had to get over the hump. I knew I had to play the game. He then shifted entirely to rock and country, saying,
I mean, I guess it's just the influence will always be in my music, but am I going to go country? I think I was born country.
So Kid Rock didn't just shift his genre. He also changed his ideology and began aligning himself with known Confederate flag supporters who stereotypically have had views that completely oppose black people. In other words, it's a flag that racists use if you're not from America. So what did Kid Rock have to say about this? Well, he said the Confederate flag was a part of his culture.
People with Confederate flags, you know, and people take that the wrong way. You know, it's heritage, not hate.
He even said once that he thinks the flag just looks cool. In a 2008 interview with The Guardian, Kid Rock said, "To me, it just represents pride in Southern rock and roll. Plus, it looks cool." What? That's crazy! Yeah, it's pretty crazy, to be honest. And when protesters try to educate him on why the flag wasn't really cool, he said, "Please tell the people who are protesting to kiss my ass, ask me some questions." So at this point, Kid Rock's public image was set. But he somehow made it worse by doubling down on his racism, using the word, and then arguing that it was harmless. But that's not the end of it. To make matters even worse, Kid Rock also took shots at black artists. In an interview with Rolling Stone, he said, "How can you be that big without at least one Sweet Home Alabama or old time rock and roll? People are like, Beyonce's hot, got a nice ass. I'm like, cool, I like skinny white chicks. Big butts don't really do much for me." Keep in mind that this is a guy who fathered a child with a black woman, but has still consistently disrespected the black community.
"All the black girls, when he was hanging out with us, he f***ed all the black girls. You know, he gotta have that image. So he went straight to Pamela Anderson. I mean, you can't get no whiter than that."
However, Kid Rock's reckless behavior didn't just stay in the music industry, because in 2013, he was sued by former employees for racial discrimination. The lawsuit came from a former black employee at one of his Detroit restaurants, Corrine Silverman, who alleged that she faced racial discrimination when she was fired after showing up to work with her hair styled in an afro. The employee claimed that her termination had nothing to do with job performance, but was a result of racial prejudice. She argued that the restaurant's claim of her being fired for overpouring a drink was an excuse to fire her after her appearance didn't fit their expectations. So yeah, I think it's clear that Kid Rock is not only racist, but also, out of all of the culture vultures we've mentioned and will mention, the worst. But another white artist who has occupied a space in black culture and has unexpectedly received accusations of being a culture vulture is Jack Harlow. Now, the thing with Jack Harlow is that he's aware of his whiteness and the privilege he is given in hip-hop due to his skin color. In fact, he's been pretty vocal about his place in hip-hop and remains optimistic about the future of the genre. "It's a novelty act. There's a certain reality that I'm white, and I think there will always be something attached to that. No matter how embraced I am, there will never be a day that I'm black." Jack Harlow even acknowledged not only his privilege, but the fact that he's a social responsibility to the genre. With that being said, there's a certain responsibility that comes with being a white man in a black genre, and there are certain things that have me regarded differently. But there's something exciting about skipping over any barriers that might be there and creating unity. He's also taking the time to talk about hip-hop and his place in it as a white dude, not just in interviews, but in songs as well. In his third album, Jackman, Harlow confronts the topic of race and cultural appropriation with the track Common Ground. In it, he tackles how white rap fans embrace the aesthetics and personas of black culture without its burdens, with lines such as "white girls squan trying to get their ass poppin', caught back talking to their moms and dads often, reciting rap lyrics about murder and cash profit, got to feel like a thug, but don't have to act on it." But Jack Harlow was also not safe from the culture vulture claims. And the most notable instance of this was when Jack was spotted wearing a bonnet at an FC game in Kentucky. Almost immediately, this sparked outrage on social media. Jack Harlow was not wearing no damn bonnet 10 years ago in his rich suburb before being a rapper. Like, what changed? One Twitter user said, "When Jack Harlow came through wearing a bonnet, that's when I knew y'all done desecrated all that is holy in the black community." But before we go any further here, let's put into context why Simple Piece headwear caused such outrage on social media. To do that, we have to understand what a bonnet is traditionally used for and by in America. And by the way, to be clear, I know this isn't like an exclusive group that uses bonnets, all right? You see, in America, a bonnet is mostly used by black women as a way to protect their hair, and even by some black men with longer hair. So when Jack Harlow wore a bonnet, he was called out for cultural appropriation. And here's why. Criticizing bonnets is rooted in anti-blackness, as they're an unapologetic symbol of black culture and are integral to the black hair care, the Teen Vogue. Seeing a white man like Jack Harlow wear an item that doesn't hold the same significance in his own culture represents a double standard that only seems to be applied to black women. Now, Jack Harlow might not be a black woman, but he does have curly hair, right? Well, despite how trivial this issue may seem for some people, the fact
at Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
The fact is that much of this criticism comes to the fact that whenever a black woman wears a bonnet in public, they get criticized for it and even called ratchet or ghetto. But when Jack does it, it's okay. So clearly, there's a lot going on here. And to this day, Jack Harlow has never addressed this controversy. But the pool of culture vultures within hip-hop is huge. Aside from the major ones we already know about, there's some smaller white hip-hop artists who are constantly being accused of being culture vultures, and for fair reason. So let me go over some with you. The first is Bad Baby. Bad Baby is a name you most likely have heard of. After becoming popular from her appearance on the Dr. Phil show, Bad Baby capitalized on her fame by becoming a social media personality and, you guessed it, rapper. But in doing so, in the eyes of many fans, she became a culture vulture because in the process of becoming a rapper, she darkened her skin and got dreads. After being called out for it, she merely responded with, "I act urban. You can't tell me I'm acting black because I braided my hair. That makes no sense whatsoever." However, another rapper who is seen equally as problematic as Bad Baby, if not more so, is someone she has beefed with in the past, Wo Vicky. In fact, Wo Vicky blew up because she told the world she was black when she looked like this. And she was yet another social media influencer who used rap to gain clout back in the day. However, she became even more controversial when she said the N-word. And when she got called out for it, she simply said, "Ancestry.com did tell me I was black. So I have the right to say I'm black." All right, really? But her rap career didn't last too long, so I'll just stop there. Another white rapper who's also a woman who has been accused of being a culture vulture over the years is Iggy Azalea. Listening to her music, you'd think she was born in the South when really she's from Australia. And she's been called out for her use of her black scent over the years. She defended herself by saying, "I lived in the South for 5 years. You pick up things from your surroundings and teachers. The people who taught me to rap are all from the South. And so was the music I had listened to as a teen." However, later on, she did admit that she raps the way she does because she knew how odd it would sound if she rapped in her native Australian accent. Yikes. And then came Vanilla Ice, who mostly rapped about the same things without experiencing them firsthand. He and his team insisted that he grew up on the streets to make him more relatable and credible to the hip-hop community as a whole.
"I'm from the streets, and if you can't see it, then you're blind as a bat, because I dance, I beatbox, you know, the stuff with the mouth."
And when asked about what his peers thought of him, he said this.
"What do the black rap artists think of you? Do they regard you seriously? Do they like your work, do you know?"
"Well, they, as in general, I don't know about they. Certain ones do, certain I'm sure don't."
But the truth was, they didn't, and he knew it. However, in later years, Ice would admit that his music was nothing more than a way to earn money.
"At that point, what was cool to me was the money.
I sold out.
It wasn't about cool anything else. What's cool is that I'm getting paid.
I'm a sellout. Wow."
Once again, X. But you see, not every white artist has an issue with this. There's one rapper, in my opinion, who today no one would call a culture vulture, and that's Mac Miller. But it's also no accident. Mac Miller was very conscious about this very thing. So I'd like to tell his story because it's almost like a guide on how not to be a culture vulture if you're a white rapper. Because somehow, Mac Miller changed from being a typical boisterous white boy to being a soulful hip-hop artist who made really deep music.
"I was just like a kid making music, and all of a sudden, I was everywhere."
As Mac Miller began to rise to fame, he slowly gained awareness that the music industry could make him the next big rapper after Eminem. If he wanted to, he could have used this opportunity to bolster his career and attain larger fame at a faster rate. He could have made music that related more to white people so that he could attract a massive white audience and boost his popularity. In an interview, he explained this. And that's kind of everyone's thing. Like, oh, Mac Miller's popping because he makes music for white kids. But it's like, if you really think I was in the studio, like, oh, this one's for the white kids. The white kids are gonna love this one. Let's go talk about kegs. Let's go do it. You know what I'm saying? That's like, wasn't what was happening at all. But instead, Mac chose to do his own thing, make music that he enjoyed and talk about the things that inspired him. And because of that mindset, his career blossomed slowly. Naturally. But Mac Miller also cared about what the hip-hop community thought of him as an artist. So in an effort to legitimize himself and make his music more credible, he dropped his frat boy persona and started writing about things that were actually going on in his life. He rapped about his internal struggles, issues with a woman, wanting to make his mama proud, and became a deeper artist. And you know what? Mac Miller did manage to earn the respect of his peers. What's more impressive is that he managed to do it on his own, without being backed by a major label or vouched for by an established black rapper, which is what helped someone like Eminem grow within the industry in the first place. And when Mac Miller did get signed to a major label, for Warner, he had already established himself as a respectable rapper independently. So throughout all of that, Mac Miller remained pretty self-aware of his white privilege that was affecting his career, and he did not ignore this fact. In an article for The Fader in 2015, Mac Miller sat with frequent collaborator and friend Vince Staples to talk about the place of white rappers in hip-hop. During this conversation, both individuals bring up interesting points about white artists in hip-hop and how they're able to receive better support than black rappers. In Mac Miller's perspective, he claimed how white rappers are seen as novelty by white hip-hop fans and have created cult-like followings, mostly exclusive to white audiences, stating, "There's always been a bunch of white rappers in the super underground scene, cult-like atmosphere. I never really listened to any of it. But there's always a lot of white people like, I love white rappers because I can identify with them. The reason why white rappers can do that is because white people be hoorahing this shit. It's like when they're white people on an NBA team," which was hilariously seconded by Vince Staples, who said, "White people definitely root for white people." And when you think about it, that can be fairly accurate. As I've consistently brought up in this video, white rappers have an opportunity to garner a bigger fan base as they have an ability that most black rappers don't. They can draw in white audiences, especially impressionable young white people outside of the hip-hop sphere. Mac even admitted being guilty to this when he saw Eminem on the TV at a young age and resonating with them. Speaking in a Fader interview with Vince Staples, he acknowledged how seeing a white rapper like Eminem actually inspired him, saying, "That's a huge reason why it's become so big now. People are like, yeah, a white guy rapping. I want to support that because not a lot of white guys rap. I remember hearing Eminem for the first time in my kitchen. I had a really little TV that was as big as my head, and The Real Slim Shady was on MTV. I definitely had a moment of being a young white kid rapping every lyric in the mirror." Mac Miller also admitted to benefiting from this, especially early on in his career. He noticed he was able to sell a lot on iTunes, and most of his sales came from white kids. And it's funny because when my 2011 album, Blue Side Park, happened, there was a huge surge of all these kids, and we were able to sell 10,000 units on iTunes just out of nowhere. But that wasn't all. His live shows were packed with white fans as well. He had thousands of white people in the audience when he toured on college campuses simply because of the color of his skin. "I remember touring and doing shows, and I was the first rap show ever in all these colleges. 6,000 kids, and I'm the first hip-hop show because I'm white college friendly. That was always a demon for me. It was hard to sit here and know that because I was a white dude. I was able to sell easier and become more marketable. That wasn't tight to me. I wanted to go through the same shit that everyone else did. But I did that, and that was huge for me." So clearly Mac wasn't happy that he was receiving attention because he was a white rapper for him. But that conversation also brought up an interesting difference between white guys who rap and white rappers as brought by Vince Staples. Are we talking about white people that can rap or white rappers? Because it's a f***ing difference. White rappers are corny. White people that rap, it's like, oh, that's what's up. You white, rap. Mac Miller responded, "Definitely. The genre of white rapper is not tight. Staples, yeah, that sh- is a genre, bro." So he was kind of like checking him there. Mac Miller knew the difference between a white rapper and a white guy who raps, and clearly he wanted to be defined as the latter. He wanted to be known as a rapper through and through who just happened to be white. And through solid albums such as The Good AM and The Divine Feminine, he did just that. But another underrated reason why Mac Miller was so respected in the hip-hop community is because he proved his love for the genre when he stayed with it despite reaching superstardom, unlike other white rappers who immediately switched genres or art forms after hip-hop made them famous. Mac Miller continued to write more hip-hop tracks. He elevated his sound and added jazz and alternative elements to his music rather than just switching genres altogether. And this is why today, you won't hear anyone calling Mac Miller a culture vulture. Is it fair that he had to be so careful in his strategy to not be labeled as one? That's up to you. However, it does show that it's possible, and that's why I think his story is important. All right, if you stayed this long in the video, I just want to thank you. Thanks. There's a couple more points I still want to make about white rappers though, so let's get into those. Another reason why white rappers have it so hard is because they don't look out for each other. Hip hop has always been a competitive genre. Just look at the recent Kendrick vs. Drake beef. This is because hip hop is among the only genres in music where rappers can literally use lyrics and art to call out, challenge, and diss their colleagues. So it's only natural for white rappers to feel like they need to take on anyone for their survival, especially since they're considered guests in the house of hip hop, which in my opinion makes them more protective of their spot. A recent example was in 2023 when MGK took jabs at Jack Harlow for Jack's bars in his track They Don't Love It. Specifically when he said, "The hardest white boy since the one who rapped about vomit and sweaters." MGK would soon respond in a freestyle saying, "I see why they call you Jackman, you Jackman's whole swag, give Drake his flow back, man." Of course, the media and fans were quick to feel the beef, and Jack essentially addressed the beef in an interview with Rap Radar saying,
"But you did say you're the hardest white boy since Eminem, and then
that's
right. People got in their feelings. Are you gonna clap back at him lyrically?
How do you take it? I guess you just take it. I don't know. Everyone is entitled to their opinion, and I feel great about what I said, and I feel great about the reaction."
To me, Jack actually faced the controversies well by not giving into the pressure of fighting off another white rapper. Because throughout the history of white rappers, it seems like they've had trouble coexisting. That's why verbal shots like what MGK did to Jack Harlow are pretty normal among white rappers and can cause harm between said artists. But to be honest, I don't think there'd be any better example to discuss other than Eminem, who himself has gone at other rappers or has taken his fair share of disses, not just from white rappers. Take for example, Dilated People's 2020 song, Eardrums Pop Remix, since this song sparked two beefs at once. Basically, Eminem misinterpreted Everlast's throwaway bar in the song, My Hammer Split a Comet like Haley Albuca 380 on ones that act shady. This bar was enough to let Eminem unleash Slim Shady, who would eventually respond with diss tracks like I Remember and Quitter, and on the track I Remember, Eminem even admits that part of their conflict might have come from both of them.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
White artists in the same space, saying, remember Sway and Tech when I came up and sat beside, guide you, I started rhyming, and you left the room and didn't say goodbye or nothing like you. Mad at someone else was white and tried to rhyme or something. Sorry, I completely butchered the delivery for those lyrics, but this is why I'm a YouTuber. But this made things tense between them. However, according to Everlast, everything was a miscommunication. And here we can understand how the spotlight of white rappers implied that Eminem had no other choice but to respond.
I say something about Haley's comment at that. I didn't know his daughter's name was Haley, but he got very upset about that part. And then that got exposed that he knew so much about, or he was so upset that he thought I had said something about his daughter, that I used that in the diss, the second diss. He was about to go to jail or something. And I said, I'll look in on your kid. I wouldn't have done that at this age as a parent.
Right.
Two dogs. I wouldn't.
But of course, Eminem wasn't done being Slim Shady just yet. On Twitter, Eminem decided to go after multiple people at once. One of his targets was Dilated People, or Rap Trio, for giving Everlast a platform to speak out against him in the first place. But in doing so, Eminem found himself in another beef, this time with Evidence, another white rapper. In an interview at People's Party with Talib Kweli, Evidence talked about how even if they had already met Eminem before and were cordial, they suddenly had no choice but to fight back.
Getting dissed by Eminem in the prime of his career was not cool at all. The real Slim Shady was out. Right. He was on over the top of the world. There was a coffee shop I used to go to in the morning, and the girl looked at me one day and just started laughing in my face.
Wow.
And she was like, what are you gonna do? That's what she told me.
With Eminem at his peak, Evidence understood that he had to do something, and that something was a diss track titled Searching for Bobby Fischer. The truth is, as much as from Detroit as you are, I'm racking up points, shit cat I'm scoring, you ain't a true tiger, liar, you from Warren. Where he called out Eminem and divulged sensitive information that he got from someone in Detroit.
So I went back and wrote a rap against him, and whether you like it, don't like it, or anything in between, I got respect. He hit me again with another diss, and it wasn't that good. He didn't have much on me. Eventually, Paul and I are cool.
Right.
I seen Eminem backstage at a festival one time with Alchemist, you know, there was a little like, we're cool. I get played on Shade 4-5. Right. Nothing really happened. I got to get respect for not backing down to somebody who was Godzilla.
Forced to fight each other. The same thing happened with these two rappers, Machine Gun Kelly and G-Eazy. It all started when MGK called out G-Eazy on a freestyle, highlighting that he stole his look and allegedly slept with his ex-girlfriend Halsey. But that's tiny compared to the beef I'm sure you've been waiting for me to get to. Because not before long, MGK found himself in a feud with Eminem. This beef is way too long for me to want to cover in this video, but just know it was very messy and MGK did not come out of it on top. This beef was pretty popular back then, and the media enjoyed every last second of it. In an interview with Howard Stern, MGK discussed the similarities with Eminem, such as his childhood and background, which made it ironic for them to have the beef in the first place, because they would be attacking the same things about each other.
Was Eminem a hero to you?
Yeah, for sure.
The guy's a great rapper. Does it personally pain you that you have this feud with this guy?
I'm like asleep in my tour bus. This guy drops an album with like three songs talking about me. I said what I said and respect the fight. That's it. The guy down the street has money. This fool has wealth beyond. I'm all about putting my arm around people. I'm not with like doing this to people. So I can't relate. The last thing I want to ever be is an angry legend.
However, Howard failed to realize that when it came to white rappers, their upbringing in the scene was the main issue. Because white rappers that are on the come up want to prove that they are here to support and help grow the culture while saying that the other white rappers are there to profit only. This is kind of like that classic Spider-Man meme that we all see on the internet. Just take a look at Eminem's diss towards Vanilla Ice and Milkbone in 1999. Am I the only one who thinks those names are kind of funny? Vanilla Ice, Milkbone.
I didn't just want to be thrown out there, you know what I mean? Like a Milkbone or like Vanilla Ice and just like try to start at the top or whatever. I want that foundation. I want the respect. I ain't in this for the money. I'm in it for the respect. I'm in it for like just for somebody to come up and say, Eminem, you're dope.
However, some white rappers don't get along since they want recognition. White rappers like Russ, who never got the respect he wanted from the culture, called out Post Malone for how he came up in the rap scene because Russ believed he used rap as an entry point to fame. According to Russ, white rappers have a job to contribute to the culture since they're guests.
If you're white in hip hop, you have to contribute to black culture in some sort of fashion. Otherwise, you are simply repeating history by coming in to black culture, using that as a medium to steal and profit for self. You can't come into this from the vessel of hip hop and use the clothes and the language and the music and then go off and start doing something.
Are you talking about Post Malone?
Russ then named Post Malone as an example of a rapper who used rap as an entry point.
I think that's a fair example. You come in with braids and golds to the point people are thinking you're mixed, and now you drink Bud Light and wear cowboy boots. You used it to propel yourself to the forefront, and then you reverted back to who you really were. I feel like I do hip-hop justice. I don't make a mockery of it. I don't portray any negative stereotypes. I don't feed into it.
So are tensions between white rappers all about them fighting for their space and being competitive, or are the feuds usually built beneath the surface? While most casual fans see this as a natural rivalry, there might be a deeper and more systematic reason for their feuds, and it's often made by the industry itself behind the scenes. But what do I mean by this? Well, record labels know that white rappers are very profitable and often create beef against each other to maximize profits by creating controversy. One clear example of industry manipulation came from R.A. the Rugged Man. He revealed that record labels once pressured him to diss Eminem during the height of his success. As Eminem became one of the biggest names in hip hop, the industry wanted R.A. to attack him publicly, fueling a rivalry between the two white rappers. R.A. eventually turned down this request and chose to share the story instead. However, if he actually rejected the offer, it really makes you think how many other white rapper versus white rapper feuds have been manufactured by record labels. And this is not the first time we've seen this, because manufactured tension is a recurring theme for white rappers. You can actually see this happen during Mac Miller's interview with Ebro, where they tried to create tension between Mac Miller and Macklemore.
You know, people always, oh, what do you think about Macklemore? Because he's killing it now. I'm like, nah, he's killing it.
Yeah,
that's awesome. And he's a good dude too. That's fine.
Two things I'd like to do. One, Macklemore, I don't know him. Right? And I'm cool with Ack Iller right now.
You're going against everything that he just said. We don't have to say Macklemore right. To like Mac Miller.
Right. It can just be cool.
Yeah, it's fine.
It can just be cool. There's no
issue.
Because
I'm going to tell you right now, there's plenty of beef between black rappers. I need white rapper beef.
Oh, but since white rappers were traditionally the minority in hip hop, they had the most beef.
It was like quiet, like
sincere.
No, I just don't want him to win because I am the white rapper.
So yeah, white rappers don't really like each other. But another common criticism fans have of white rappers is how corny their lyricism and antics can be at times. While this doesn't necessarily make them culture vultures per se, it doesn't exactly bode well for the reputation of white rappers. And there are a couple of rappers in the industry that I do believe love rap and respect the culture, but just the way they carry themselves, their music, their onstage appearance, just make them come off as corny. I'm talking about rappers like Macklemore, Logic, rappers that may appreciate the genre more than they appropriate, but their music just stops them from being as respected as white rappers such as Eminem or Mac Miller. For example, there was a time when Logic couldn't stop telling the world he was biracial to the point where he became a meme for it. Then you have rappers that make up for mediocre lyricism with speed, rappers that rap fast for the sake of rapping fast. But when you slow down their music or read their lyrics closely, you find that there's really nothing there. White rappers that fall under this category include Tom McDonald, Logic, and NF. Rappers that sound impressive to the average listener or fans of this specific type of music, but are considered mediocre to most hip-hop fans. But as I said, having said all that, these white rappers don't necessarily harm the culture, but they do damage the reputation of white rappers further, preventing future aspiring rappers who are white from being taken seriously when they enter the hip-hop community with all the best intentions. However, speed rappers are just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to white rap. A more popular genre that's given rappers the corny label is frat rap, the subgenre that Mac Miller kind of started out making. Birthed and popularized by the Pennsylvania rapper Asher Roth, frat rap is a subgenre of rap that's specifically centered around the frat boy lifestyle in college. Since Asher Roth's I Love College single, a slew of white rappers talking about alcohol, partying, and girls have all come out the woodworks. And the unique aspect of frat rap in the world of hip-hop is that it's target audience is mostly white people. This means that rappers under the subgenre do not have the burden of pleasing their black peers. They can exist in their own bubble, indulging in the hedonism that clouds over the life of a college student, and become rich and famous in the process. Although white frat rappers could not care less about the rest of the hip-hop community, or at least they pretend to, it didn't stop the rest of the hip-hop community to make their criticism. Frat rap has often been criticized for its lack of creative lyricism, an aspect that is heavily important in hip-hop, and for lacking any further substance other than ones found in party. Of course, frat rap and the artists in it are also criticized for cultural appropriation, since most, if not all, frat rap artists were white men. Nevertheless, frat rap remained fairly popular during the late 2000s. It's even paved the way for a handful of now well-known rappers such as Mac Miller and Lil Dicky. Many mainstream artists also dipped their toes in frat rap music, even black hip-hop artists and rappers such as Chris Brown, Snoop Dogg, and Kid Cudi. In the following years, the popularity of frat rap would slowly die down, and a handful of rappers within the genre would also move out of it. By far, Mac Miller has been the most popular rapper to ever come out of the frat rap genre successfully. Another subgenre to come out of the white world of hip-hop is nerd rap, also known as nerdcore. However, unlike frat rap, you could say there's a lot of style and creativity that goes into making nerd rap records, as crazy as that sounds, although it most likely just appeals to white people. So, what is nerd rap? Popularized by MC Frontalot in the early 2000s, nerdcore is centered around topics that are of interest in the nerd and geek community. This includes anything from science fiction, anime, video games, to computers, science, and politics. And since the genre centers around nerd culture, nerdcore has a tendency of being whimsical to serious listeners and non-appreciators of anything geeky or nerdy. However, you could say nerdcore records actually places heavy emphasis on creativity, wittiness, and heavy wordplay. Some of the most popular songs in nerdcore in its infancy were a song about Halo and a song that was anti-Microsoft. A song that featured the lyrics, "The operating system is so old, it was a horror story my grandfather told." Damn, that was crazy. Yo, thanks for watching. Appreciate you for watching all the way through, really. Check out the rest of my channel if you like this video, and see you next time. Bye.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.